kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine, you have stood by me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have lots to share about why you should give a second thought before getting a tattoo. Also, a nutrient and a fiber protects against a major disease and turns off inflammation. We'll tell you about that. Also, people who are happier and enjoy life, it actually can now be shown it slows down the aging process. Well, I think we didn't need a study to know that. Increasing the intake of a fatty acid reduces diabetes. And tangerines, that's our nutrient of the day, our fruit of the day. And I'll tell you all about a particular nutrient that they discovered in tangerines that, well, it can help with a long list of diseases, that and more, in our health and nutrition segment. Always information citing the mainstream peer-reviewed literature. Now, for long-term listeners, they know why I do this. For newer listeners, here's why. Because there is a major effort underway now to try to suppress alternative therapies and the individuals who are given a form. Virtually every holistic medical doctor, chiropractic, naturopath, herbalist, osteopath, they're attacked the moment they suggest that the body should be used, the mind as well, in its healing process to prevent disease. Now you think, well, why shouldn't we be more interested in prevention? Because we like to believe that the medical community is all-knowing, all-good, benevolent, and that they're the best and brightest. But then we find out that they kill more people each year than anything else in America, more than heart attacks or strokes or cancer or diabetes. They injure more people in 1 year than all other accidents in 20 years. That's every year. So when you look back and you realize that tens of millions of Americans have died trusting a medical industrial complex paradigm, and we spend $3.3 trillion, more than twice what we spend on the military-industrial spy complex each year. And no one talks about this. No one anywhere in the United States that we could find, and we've done a complete search, says, why don't we completely examine all of medicine and hold it up to a gold standard? No one would be given any test, unless it was proven it was necessary. There would be no defensive medicine, no unnecessary medications. We wouldn't make up diseases that do not exist, like social anxiety disorder and restless leg syndrome and adult defiance disorder, authority defiance disorder. Just hundreds of diseases just don't exist, simply to sell a drug. We wouldn't allow that. We wouldn't allow people to have non-cancerous but fatty deposits removed with radical mastectomies. We wouldn't do that. We wouldn't be giving chemotherapy that has never been proven in any qualified study to increase the quality of life measurably. We wouldn't allow it. So you see, virtually 88% of all of medicine has never been held to a high standard. You think it has not. Just like you believe that vaccines are safe and effective because so many people support them and promote them. And could they all be wrong? Yes, they're all wrong, including most of the people on the left. Particularly, I hold disdain for those corporate ideologues on the left, including on some of our sister stations, who refuse to go after the pharmaceutical industry for its crimes against humanity or other. They won't even look at any authentically proven conspiracy. And yet, we are told, don't question, obey. Why should we? We should be challenging. And that's what we do. So to show that we're not just pulling some mythical concept out of the air, take this herb, try this vitamin, choose this diet, and we think it'll help you, we cite the actual high-quality, independent, peer-reviewed literature from respected institutions, and we share that with you. So the next time someone says, oh, there's no, that's just all quackery, no. No, it isn't. It's legitimate, and that's why we share it. Let's begin. My guest, by the way, in the second part of our program is Liz Kennedy, and we're going to talk about the fourth anniversary today of the Supreme Court Citizen United ruling. How has it threatened our democracy and the pending McCutcheon case in the court to expand even further Citizen United? We'll talk about that in depth and why it really hurts us. Also, I'm going to have a debate between Glenn Greenwald and a reporter for The Washington Post and show you what Glenn Greenwald can do when he faces an individual who is pro, well, of course, The Washington Post is pro-Obama. Also, I will continue with my challenge against the most corrupt, vile treaty in American history, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Two separate reports about the industry powers that you have not known about who have direct access to the Trans-Pacific Partnership plans and how they gave lavish amounts of money to members of Congress and what that means. So when you think your legislator's going to do the right thing, don't count on it. And also how they're trying, a bipartisan, Democrat and Republican alike, are trying to fast-track this and why we have to stop them. We all hold most of Congress in utter contempt. These are the lowest of low in the human scale. I don't know if you could get any lower. You'd have to go below amoeba, in my opinion, to maintain the character or lack of the immorality of members of our, of everywhere. I mean, the whole damn Washington, D.C. should just be designated a Superfund toxic septic system where people gladly, willingly rush off from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, Columbia, and Stanford to get what they can for themselves. And they do every day. And I will continue to hold that mirror up. A lot of people have this idea that a tattoo is really cool. Well, it might be. It's perfectly subjective. You know, if you like it, you like it, you do it. If you don't, you don't. But do you know what's in the ink? Ah, no, you should. Because would you knowingly inject dangerous heavy metals that can go to your brain and will, such as mercury and lead and arsenic, into your body? Well, according to Natural News, how about carcinogens and endocrine disruptors, such as the phthalates and the hydrocarbons? Chances are that is exactly what you've done if you've had a tattoo, because those substances are commonly found in the inks used for tattoos. Many tattoo inks contain heavy metals that have been linked to a large number of health problems, including cancer and neurodegenerative disease. Now, among the most concerning metals found are the ones I just mentioned, but also, aside from arsenic and cadmium and lead and mercury, you also have beryllium. Very dangerous. Now, mercury is a neurotoxin. We've discussed it many times on this program because it's in the flu vaccine, in the H1N1 vaccine. And it is extremely detrimental to every human being who gets its nervous system. It can damage your brain and lead to physical and emotional disorders. Lead interferes with your body's processes and can attack your body organs, mainly your heart, your bones, your intestines, your kidney, your nervous and reproductive system. And it can cause seizures, coma, and death. And cadmium is bad for your kidneys, your bone, and your pulmonary. Arsenic is a really bad carcinogen, and it can cause damage to all your genes in your body and kill you. And the hydrocarbons and the phthalates are dangerous. So just remember that when you get your tattoo, you're also getting all these other things that you didn't want. And tattoo removal can also send a cascade of dangerous chemicals throughout the body. Why? Because as time goes by, many people originally opted for tattoos decide they'd like to have them removed. Now, according to the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology, 18% of 50-year-olds with tattoos, or up to 50-year-olds, want to have them removed. And here's what they don't understand. Removal of a tattoo can be even more dangerous than getting a tattoo in the first place. By far the most common method of removing tattoos today is laser tattoo removal, a technique where a laser is used to repeatedly go in and dissolve the tattoo. But once the tattoo inks are dissolved, their components, including any dangerous ones, like the ones I just mentioned, are absorbed directly into the blood, and that's a bad thing, because they can never be fully eliminated under normal living conditions. You have to go through chelation therapy to get those out. And in higher amounts, that's bad. An estimated 45 million Americans have at least one tattoo. And so just keep that in mind. Vitamin B3, which is really important, niacin, and fiber protect against colon cancer and inflammation. And this is from Georgia Regents University. Quote, previous research has suggested a diet rich in fiber may reduce the risk of colon inflammation and cancer. But new research suggests that niacin, also known as vitamin B3, may also help protect against these conditions. Now, you don't need a lot of this, but I would suggest that with using the non-flush niacin, because if you take the normal niacin, and with each person the tolerance level is different, normally 100 milligrams is fine. There may be someone who it's not. Some people can go up to 300 or 400 milligrams before they get the flush. But if you're not aware that you get a niacin flush, it can mimic a heart attack. But it also freaks people out. Your skin becomes just hot, and you turn beet red, and your heart starts to pound. And people who don't look in the mirror and see that they're beet red think they're having a heart attack. Now, it goes away in about a half hour, but that's why you want to get the non-flush niacin. And then the best way of getting your fiber is from natural fibers. All of them, legume, fruit, vegetable, they're all good for you. Some people ask, what about quinoa? Quinoa is Q-U-I-N-O-A. Quinoa. Well, I have found that it's extremely well tolerated across all the people who normally have gluten intolerances or even celiac disease. Well, now there's a new report out to confirm that. And this was from the American College of Gastroenterology. And here's what it says. Quote, adding quinoa to a gluten-free diet of patients with celiac disease is well tolerated and does not exacerbate the condition. And this was published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology. It was done at the Department of Gastroenterology, King's College, London. So those of you who were saying, well, should I have quinoa or should I not have quinoa? Yeah, it's a great, great little, and use the red quinoa. That's really got a little better taste to it than the non-red quinoa. It's kind of a pale, slightly little yellow. And quinoa and millet go together very nicely also. And you can substitute it instead of rice or barley or rye. I think we've all known for a long time, just intuitively, that happy people live longer lives. And I once read a little book called Happy People Seldom Get Cancer. And I found at the time when I was reading it, I was very young, gee whiz, could this really be true? Well, now we have a whole field of science with thousands upon thousands of studies called psychoneuroimmunology. Psycho, the brain. Neuro, your nervous system. Immunology, or your immune system. So in effect, what you think will immediately impact how you feel and also your state of immunity. So if someone's sick, you don't want to lay anything heavy on them. You want something light and joyful. And that's why when I spoke with Norman Cousins, he was talking about watching comedies. He would rent movies and watch them that would make him laugh. And he had mentioned in a good discussion that he knew Larry Leshan. Well, I work with Larry Leshan. And this was Larry Leshan was the bridge between Hans Selye, the father of distress therapy. He was the one who saw that stress is good, distress is bad. You know, if you're getting ready for a fun event or going out to a concert, a ball game, that's stress, but that's good. If you're filled with anxiety and anger and rage and depression and fear and insecurity, that's bad. So one is distress, bad. One is stress, good. And I also knew Hans Selye and had many conversations with him. Because I was at the beginning of my career, he was at the end of his long distinguished career he had, and everyone else really was standing on his shoulders, like the entire environmental movement stood on. The right shoulder was Ralph Nader, the left shoulder was Rachel Carson. And we are indebted to them because they, more than anyone else, created the awareness of the association between a toxic environment and our health. In any case, then Larry Leshan, who was a great psychologist and was over at the Institute of Applied Biology, we had these conversations about, he said, Gary, if you want to see people are going to live longer lives, look for the ones that smile a lot. Look for the ones that have joy. And he said, those are the ones that are going to live the longest life. He said, now what you're doing here, you know, helping the patients at Trafalgar Hospital and working with all your rats upstairs, getting them to live a longer... I had the third floor, which was no one ever came up to because they thought what I was doing was too esoteric. They were doing the hard chemotherapy and, you know, the drug work downstairs. I was the eccentric one, feeding rats wheatgrass juice and carrot juice and not putting any of them in a cage, all open environment. And playing music and hiding their food so they would have to search it out. And you'd walk in there any day, and many of you did. Thousands of you came up to the Institute because I would go to work in the evening after I finished my regular day, and then I would work because I don't need a lot of sleep, and I like to keep my brain creative, and I had a glass wall down the one side, and people could go in there and sit on one side not to contaminate what was going on. And they could watch all this, and people would be freaked out saying, you know, 10, 15 rats running all over my desk and, you know, one sitting on my shoulder. Never got bitten, not once. In any case, he said, we should create happy time. I said, what do you mean happy time? He said, where we just take a time out each day from all the things that cause us distress, and just do something that creates happiness. And I said, you know, I know someone who does that each day. No matter what's going on, that person goes down to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, one of the greatest art museums in the world, goes into an inner sanctuary there. I'm sure any of you have gone there, where they have the fountains and the foliage, and you look out to the left as you walk in and you see Central Park and it's two stories in there. It's just a wonderful environment. And that person would sit there and read and relax and enjoy that environment and then go back to practicing medicine on the Upper East Side. This is a friend of mine, so and when I said, why do you do this? He said, well, why don't you try this? So I didn't want to go to the museum because I found it too crowded. Instead, I went to the Frick. If you've never been to the Frick, it's on Fifth Avenue, around 70th Street, and it's inside. It has a reflection pool with a fountain and this vaulted glass ceiling and ivy growing. Very beautiful. Not very crowded in the week. On the weekends, yes, not during the week. So I found the same thing, just sitting there and just relaxing, just being present. And then I understood what he was saying. Happy time, where you don't have a cell phone, you're not focused on, you're just present. And he was absolutely right. He even could predict who could get cancer, would get cancer, based upon how they dealt with stress, distress. So I found it was fun to be around people who would later be proven right, even though we may not remember those people. Here's the latest. And again, they can thank Dr. Lawrence Lachan and Dr. Hans Selye, the two shoulders that an entire three generations stood on to have psychoneuroimmunology. This is from Dr. Andrew Steptoe at the University College London. They did an in-depth analysis about happy and people who enjoyed life. Quote, people who enjoy life maintain better physical function in daily activities, walk at faster speeds as they age, and live longer lives. The participants were divided in different categories, and then they did all this analysis and found out that when you're happy, you're not stressed. Well, there's something they didn't add here. By the way, this was published in the mainstream peer-reviewed journal, the Canadian Medical Association Journal, much like our American Medical Association Journal. When you're happy, you don't have stress hormones going off. Cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, catecholamines, adrenaline. Instead, you have positive hormones that are secreted. The positive hormones have an epigenetic relationship with your cells and hence protect the telomeres and the chromosomes and don't create the inflammatory cytokines. In effect, happiness turns off the flames. Anxiety, depression, rage turns on the flames of inflammation. That's one of the reasons that we pay attention to that. And finally, when you take the long chain omega acids, the omega-3s, you can reduce your risk of diabetes. Now, this is published in the peer-reviewed journal of Diabetes Care, and it is significant when you can help yourself. Now, the omega-3 fatty acids, I would say 2,000 milligrams a day. This was done at the University of East Finland, and a major improvement when they had their omega-3 fatty acids. And also, if you're reducing your risk of diabetes, you're also reducing your risk of heart disease because they're associated. I'm Gary Nall. Now let's go to a debate, because we rarely have a chance to see Glenn Greenwald, and especially when he's debating someone who really represents an institution in the Washington Post, which is now owned by a man who has a $600 million contract with the CIA, and how she defends their pro-national security stance, and Glenn Greenwald challenges it.
Welcome back to The Lead. I'm Jake Tapper. Now it's time for The World Lead. If you were Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor who stole and then leaked information that revealed a massive surveillance web operating in secret, would you come back to the U.S.? On one hand, you could keep your freedom, relatively speaking, in Vladimir Putin's Russia. On the other, you could return home and be immediately thrown behind bars by an enraged government that many of which the members of the government have labeled you a traitor, maybe for the rest of your life. Tough choice, right? And not one Snowden should have to make, according to two prominent newspaper editorial boards. The editorial boards of both the New York Times and The Guardian are calling on the government of Barack Obama to give him a pass, or at least a deal. The Times board, generally a reliable supporter of the Obama administration, disagrees with the White House on Snowden to an almost shocking extent, writing, quote, he may have committed a crime, but he has done his country a great service. It is time for the United States to offer Mr. Snowden a plea bargain or some form of clemency. Joining me now is Glenn Greenwald, investigative journalist for First Look Media. He broke scoop after scoop on the NSA using information that Snowden gave to him. Also with me here in studio, Ruth Marcus, columnist for The Washington Post, who just wrote a piece calling Snowden a, quote, insufferable whistleblower. Ruth, I'm going to start with you. The Times board also writes, when someone reveals that government officials have routinely and deliberately broken the law, that person should not face life in prison at the hands of the same government. Do you agree with the Times that Snowden should get some form of clemency?
No, I don't. In fact, I think he should have, if he really believes in the Constitution, as I wrote, he should have stuck around, tested the constitutional system, taken his punishment, argued that he was justified in the leaks that he did. He didn't. He just turned tail and fled the country.
Glenn, I'm sure you want to respond to that.
I want to say two things. I think Ruth Marcus's argument exemplifies everything that's really horrible about the D.C. media. First of all, what she said is just completely factually false. If he had stayed in the United States, as Daniel Ellsberg, widely considered to be a hero by most Americans, argued in the Washington Post, he would have been barred from making the very argument that she just said he should have made. Under the Espionage Act, you're not allowed to come into court and say, I was justified in disclosing this information. There is no whistleblower exception in the Espionage Act, which is why whistleblowers don't get justice in the United States. But I think the really important point is that people in Washington continuously make excuses for those in power when they break the law. Ruth Marcus was one of the leaders in 2008 saying that Bush officials that torture people shouldn't be prosecuted, they should be protected. She praised and protected FBI agents in the 70s who entered people's homes without warrants and were criminally prosecuted. She said they shouldn't have been prosecuted. That's what people in Washington do. They would never call on someone like James Clapper, who got caught lying to Congress, which is a felony, to be prosecuted. They only pick on people who embarrass the government and the administration to which they're loyal, like Edward Snowden. It's not about the rule of law.
Ruth?
Well, first of all, actually, I think James Clapper lied to Congress, and I don't think that he should be in office. And I wrote a column saying exactly that. But let's
should
go back to the.
Should he be prosecuted? Should he be prosecuted?
Well, you know,
just answer that. Should James Clapper be prosecuted? You just said the rule
of
law
is
really important.
You know what? I let you make your point. Why don't you let me make mine,
Let's just answer that question,
because then we're going to get involved in a whole conversation about what the exact elements of perjury are. And I don't think I want to get into that. Let's talk about Edward Snowden instead of calling people names and making accusations. The fact is that look at the Ellsberg example. Yes, he wrote a very interesting column in my newspaper, The Washington Post, saying that he agreed with Snowden, that Snowden should have fled. But what did Ellsberg do? He came forward. He said he thought it was his responsibility as an American citizen after actually he tried to get his information to the Senate and have the Senate reveal the information. When that whistleblowing didn't work, he took it to reporters. And so that's one big difference. And the second big difference is he stuck around, came forward, said, fine, go ahead and prosecute me. The prosecution failed because his rights had been violated, but the system worked for him. Edward Snowden didn't give the system a chance to work for him.
Glenn, go ahead.
All right, first of all, why won't Ruth Marcus answer the question, should the top officials in the Obama administration, to which she's a loyalist, why shouldn't they, after they got caught lying by the documents that Mr. Snowden came forward to publish? Remember, when I met him in Hong Kong, the first thing he said to me is, I have documents proving that the top national security officials in the U.S. Congress have been misleading the public and lying to Congress, which is a crime. And he gave us the documents that show that James Clapper lied when he denied that the U.S. government was collecting data on millions of Americans. Why won't she answer the question, should he be prosecuted for him having broken the law, just like she said Edward Snowden should be? And I'll tell you the answer, because people in Washington who are well connected to the government like she is do not believe that the law applies to them. They only believe that the law should be used to punish people and imprison people who don't have power in Washington or who expose the wrongdoing of American political officials. And as far as Daniel Ellsberg is concerned, just go read what he wrote. He said the world is completely different now. The U.S. government does not allow whistleblowers like they allowed him to stay out of jail trial to make their case to the public. If Edward Snowden came back to Washington before he was convicted of anything, he would be disappeared in prison
Edward
and not
Snowden,
be allowed to speak.
Why didn't Edward Snowden behave like Daniel Ellsberg and try to work through the system in order to try to get his information public? Daniel Ellsberg tried to work through the system before he went. No, he didn't. He went and he complained a little bit to some of his coworkers at the NSA, he says. That's all that he did. But let me give you an answer to the Clapper question, because you seem to be focused on it, so fine. If you want to spend time doing that, we can do that. The answer to the Clapper question is absolutely. If federal prosecutors believe that they could make a case under the perjury statute, which I know that you know as well as I do, Glenn, is a very difficult case to make that shows a knowing and material misrepresentation, then fine, go right ahead. I don't happen to think that the criminal law is going to get you where you should go on the Clapper front, but I take a backseat to nobody in saying that I thought Clapper's testimony was false and that he should be ashamed of it, and it's totally intolerable.
Glenn, let me read something for you from Josh Barrow at the Business Insider. He tweeted this out, and I just want to get your response to this. Josh wrote, "The case for clemency for Snowden is a radical case against our diplomatic and intel apparatus, which people make oddly casually. And if Snowden had only revealed the reach of NSA inside the U.S. and not divulged the methods, extent, et cetera, do you think then there would be a better case for clemency? Do you think that by going as far as he did, he undermined his ability to come back to the United States? He could have taken it, he could have done a little bit and started the debate, is I guess the argument Josh is making."
All right, well, first of all, the United States indicted him under espionage statutes and charged him with crimes that would put him into prison for 3 decades before the fourth or fifth story was even published, when just the first couple of stories had been published. Secondly, as all kinds of journalists, including from Ruth's own paper, have continuously pointed out, the Obama administration is more aggressive and more vindictive when it comes to punishing whistleblowers than any administration in all of American history, including the Nixon administration. All sorts of whistleblowers in the past who have come forward and used the proper channels, as Ruth calls them, or disclosed only a little bit, like Tom Drake, have had been prosecuted, have had their lives destroyed. And the problem in Washington is the system is designed to prevent whistleblowers from being able to get to the public what it is they want to know. Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, two Democratic senators on the Intelligence Committee, already knew about what Mr. Snowden made public. They've been warning the public for years that they should know about this and be alarmed about it. But even those two powerful senators were barred by the law and were too afraid to tell the public what they knew. That's why Mr. Snowden did what he did. He knew there was no way inside the system to make his fellow citizens aware of what their government was doing to their privacy.
Ruth, it is true that the Obama administration has used the Espionage Act more to go after whistleblowers who have leaked to journalists, not just than any previous administration, but then more than all previous administrations combined. So the argument that Ellsberg makes, that it's a different environment than the 70s, might be accurate, no?
Yeah, well, I think there has been an excessive use of the whistleblower, an excessive use of power against whistleblowers. And I also think, because I see the world in, Glenn sees the world in black and white terms, I see it in gray terms, which makes me, you know, apparently a complete tool of the establishment. I think that Snowden, piece of his disclosure has been a public service. And so when I look at this, I really balance the equities of how much he disclosed. I thought Josh's point that you raised is a very good point. Perhaps if he had just told us only about the metadata program, perhaps if he had tried ways to reveal that elsewhere, the whole establishment, if you will, wouldn't be so up in arms. But he stole, let's use the right words for it, an enormous amount of data and spilled it out there. And we still don't know the exact consequences of it. I know Glenn any second is going to say, show me exactly what the harm is to national security. But you know and I know that that's the issue. You can't actually always show the harm or show. It's not like giving the name of a spy and the next thing you know, he's executed. There is a gray, unknowable area here, and I just find his attitude, which I called insufferable, and I'll stand by that.
Snowden's,
and
I
also
point out, not
his. Sorry, Glenn.
No,
you know,
Snowden's, not
we could discuss that too. Just really troubling and reprehensible. Even though I simultaneously think there has been a value to. We are having a really important public debate, and I wish it's the NSA's fault, and I've been critical of them as well, that we weren't able to have that otherwise.
Glenn, do you really think that, and the truth is we have no, as Ruth points out, we have no idea, but do you really think that this hasn't damaged in any way these disclosures, the ability of our national security apparatus to actually accomplish some things truly in the name of protecting innocent people?
Jake, we do know. We do have evidence. The federal court 2 weeks ago and President Obama's own handpicked panel that studied this for months and wrote a very detailed report both said that the administration keeps claiming that these programs are necessary to stop terrorist plots, and yet there is no evidence that can be identified, they said, that in any way shows that these programs are necessary to do that. Terrorism is what government officials just immediately start yelling, and they've been doing this for 12 years whenever they get caught doing things that they shouldn't actually be doing. It's just a fear-mongering technique. There's no reason the United States government needs to collect not just people's metadata, as Ruth keeps saying. They also collect people's content, including Americans' content. Ruth said in her column that the content of my calls remains off limits. That's totally false. Under the 2008 FISA law, the U.S. government and the NSA do collect, without warrants, the telephone communication of American citizens when they speak internationally with people they're targeting. That was the whole purpose of the law. This is this incredibly pervasive surveillance state.
You do not need,
Jake, to be collecting billions of calls and email, billions every day, as the NSA does. You can target the people that you suspect of engaging in wrongdoing who are terrorists and monitor their communications. That will actually make stopping plots more effective than if you're aiming it at the entire citizenry, as the NSA currently is doing.
All right, I'm going to give Ruth the last word.
Well, Glenn is conflating two things. The president's handpicked panel, as he said, did say that there wasn't proof that the metadata program had stopped any crimes, but that any terrorist activities. But that isn't proof that Snowden's disclosures haven't harmed national security. So he's trying to confuse
people
with
that. Because there are other programs he disclosed.
Because there are other programs. The disclosures were massive, and yeah, we don't know.
Why don't you try this on? Why don't we talk about what would happen if we asked the citizens of the world, where we have been regime changing, and those who've been victims of our drone attacks, and the Iraqi families in the early 1990s who saw 500,000 of their children die due to the sanctions, what impact that had? How does that damage our reputation? Or is that off limits? We'll bring you these debates because they're not in the mainstream when we hear them. And that was Glenn Greenwald and a reporter for The Washington Post. I'm Gary Knoll. In a moment, we're going to go to our guest, who is standing by, Liz Kennedy. Liz is the counsel for DEMOS, a public policy organization dedicated to the promotion of democracy and equal fairness in our political and economic processes. Liz's work focuses on money and politics and the increase of transparency and voting rights and corporate accountability. Earlier, she was an attorney in the Democracy Program at New York University School of Law, representing unions and labor democracy cases. And her writings have appeared in, well, The American Prospect, National Civic Review, Boston Herald, Huffington Post, and she received her Doctor of Jurisprudence from New York University School of Law, and the website is demos.org. We'll go to her in just a second, but I just want to mention that not always can someone be in front of a radio or even listening over the Internet, but you can always take your cell phone. And the nice thing is that from any telephone in the United States or Canada, you can call in and listen to this program. Let me give you the two numbers. The numbers are 401-347-0456, 401-347-0456, or 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231. Also, my producer, executive producer of our documentary division, Valerie, says we need to do a little bit more filming. I thought this week I was wrapping up on the road. Evidently, we still have to. We're looking for some homeless families that would like to tell us their story on camera. Any senior citizens who have found that their pensions have been eviscerated, they have had to substantially change their lifestyles. And we need citizens, senior citizens, we need your stories. Foreclosures. What happens when a home is foreclosed? We never hear about the struggles and the crisis of people who have lost their homes. Those of you who've lost your pensions, and it was your pensions that you were relying upon for your retirement. People have come out of prison. What's it like to try to reenter the workforce? What kind of challenges do you face? College graduates, how do you face the world today if there may not be a job matching your educational skills or a job at all, or the job you have is really under what you should be doing as far as financially or academically? These are the areas we'd like to hear from people. Let me give you the number if you'd like to be filmed. Our documentary is in full swing production, a full team. I'm the one on the road doing the writing and directing and filming, and I send it up back every night, and then they work on it. This is the end of 5 years of working on this film. It will be out in August. 646-926-5441. 646-926-5441. The senior producer is Valerie, and that will wrap up our final filming. Let's say hello now to Liz Kennedy. Hi, Liz.
Hello, Gary.
Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
A couple of years ago, you wrote a piece on how the Citizens United versus the FEC ruling endangers our democracy. So now we're 4 years today since the Supreme Court made private corporations citizens. In 2012 alone, 100 of the wealthiest people in America were able to give $339 million to super PACs, and this in turn becomes secret or shadow money. So I'd like for you to give an analysis after I just give a little bit of the overview of this, and then I want you to talk about, has the Supreme Court's ruling eroded the democratic equality of citizens' votes in favor of big business and the wealthiest of Americans? There are only about seven of these. The first is, how has Citizens United increased the power and influence of the super PACs? Let's start with that one.
Sure. Well, again, thanks so much for having me on today, the fourth anniversary of Citizens United. I think it's critically important that we remember that this is a new normal, that we've always, unfortunately, in the last 30, 35 years since the campaign finance reforms were implemented after Watergate, there's a cycle where some reforms are implemented, then they get weakened. But what we have now seen is a concerted effort over the past decades to get the court to strike down really all of these common sense regulations and rules that we need in order to protect our democratic government from being dominated by big money donors. And unfortunately, as you said, in Citizens United, the court said that corporations had the same First Amendment rights as human beings, essentially, to spend outside in outside money. And that's why we saw the growth of super PACs. As you say, individual Americans are still allowed to contribute only $2,600 per election to federal candidates. Corporations are still barred from directly spending through candidate avenues. But even though the Supreme Court didn't change those facts, its ruling made them far less relevant because it did, as you say, open the door for this explosion in outside spending, which has really led to a place where our politics and now our policymaking is far too indebted to those who have the deepest pockets rather than to all of us in terms of just our regular rights as American citizens. In fact, you noted that there were $313 million was the amount of small donor money that was raised directly by both the Obama and the Romney campaign. But that took from more than 3.5 million individual donors. It took just 32 donors to super PACs who were able to give an average contribution of about $10 million to equal that. And so when we see regular people who, you know, the average American household income is just over $50,000, and yet then we're seeing other individuals, a tiny fraction, being able to give, you know, $50,000 to a super PAC if they see fit, then we really have to question how that is representative of our democratic values and how we are going to be able to keep a semblance of a real representative government, which is to say a government that represents all of our interests, when our elected representatives need to find themselves in the current system needing to raise or able to raise this huge money from just the wealthiest few.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. How has this led to what I personally consider is legal money laundering by corporations through our elected electoral process?
Yep. I would also agree with you that this is, to the extent that we understand money laundering as being sending money through channels so as to obfuscate its original source, this is absolutely money laundering. To clarify, because this is a very detailed area, although, of course, anyone of goodwill can understand the necessary elements, really, super PACs, at the very least, are required to disclose their donors. However, in addition to the rise of super PACs, what Citizens United has led to is this massive growth in political nonprofits. So that's where a lot of this shadowy Koch network money is floating through these groups that either are named, like, seriously, just numbers and letters, or are named, you know, Freedom-Loving Americans for Freedom or some completely anodyne and name that gives voters no information. So prior to Citizens United, groups like the Sierra Club or the NRA were able to use their C4s, their political nonprofit arms, or rather their nonprofit arms that were allowed to do a little bit of trying to impact actual elections. But if voters saw an ad that said paid for by the NRA or paid for by the Sierra Club, at the very least, they likely were able to gain some understanding of, you know, why and how, what that relationship was and what the group was attempting to stand for, why they might have been supporting a candidate. Unfortunately, we saw over $300 million in dark money flood our elections in 2012. That's just the federal elections. There's even more dark money going on really under the radar in the state. And that is a really dangerous and absolutely new situation. It is also, by the way, something that when Justice Kennedy wrote the decision in Citizens United, he absolutely understood that all of that money would be disclosed. He said, now that we have the internet, all of this money will be transparent, and so shareholders will be able to exercise accountability, and voters will know, you know, if the candidates are in the so-called pockets of moneyed interest. However, he struck this legislation into a vacuum, and since before his decision, all of the spending had to go through the avenues that were already set up and that already had disclosure requirements attendant to them, when he just struck the ban on direct corporate spending, there was no rule that said or law that said that all of this new corporate money had to be disclosed. And so that is absolutely why the Securities and Exchange Commission is 4 years behind its needed task to adopt a common sense corporate political disclosure rule so that any of this new corporate spending will be transparent to investors and they will be able to hold them accountable for it.
The court took the stance that money does not corrupt. Therefore, it ignored all ethical and moral issues in its ruling in favor of Citizens United. And since then, in our recent elections that you just mentioned, how have we seen that, in fact, money can corrupt through Citizens United?
Sure. the very idea, as you say, that they said money is not corrupt is an instance where the court is just blinded to the actual reality of how its decisions play on the ground. I will also say they were blinded to reality when they struck down critical, important elements of the Voting Rights Act that had done such good work over the years to protect the voting rights of Americans. There's really something that they are not seeing in their ivory chamber about the way that power flows through our system and the way that both economic domination and then cutting back people's abilities to come to the polls to try to participate and have their voices heard that way are problems. This, what the court did say was that access and influence are not corruption. But of course, access and influence are the coin of the realm. And what we're really talking about is also setting the policy agenda. Senator Chris Murphy noted that he has to spend about 4 to 6 hours calling donors in order to raise money. And he says he's not calling anyone who isn't dropping at least $1,000. He estimates that those folks all make at least between $500,000 to $1 million per year. And he goes on to say that these people have fundamentally different problems than other people in Connecticut. He says, so you're hearing a lot about problems that bankers have and not a lot of problems that people who work at the mill have. You certainly have to stop and check yourself. So what we see is when we don't see unemployment insurance extended to our fellow Americans who have been looking for work in this economy and yet haven't been able to find it, when you see that we have not taken action, the necessary action to push through a jobs bill, to really get America moving again, and get businesses hiring again, and use the federal government to make economic choices that actually benefit the ordinary people of America. You know, money and politics is at the root of the fact that we haven't seen getting rid of the carried interest tax, the fixation on the debt and the deficit without the understanding that what we really need right now in our country are long-term investments in our people and our future. For the economic elite, there's much more of a concern about debt and deficit and tax relief, whereas for the majority of Americans, there's much more of a concern with investing in higher education. You know, when we see the majority of Americans supporting particular economic policies that really would benefit us and the whole country, and yet government doesn't even have that on its radar for a large extent, I think we can look at whose interest is the government really responsive to.
My final concern is that I believe that Citizens United has increased corporate power, such as the banks and mega transnational corporations. At the same time, you and I only have one vote. So average citizens are unable to compete with corporations and wealthy persons in promoting political candidates. And so how has Citizen United disempowered the average citizen's voting power? At the same time, what has it done for the power base of the mega transnational corporations?
Sure. Well, I think that that's what we've been talking about today, that the fact is most Americans believe that their elected officials are more responsive to their moneyed contributors than they are to their constituents or even to the public interest. And in fact, 80% of Americans agree that they're worried that large political contributions prevent Congress from tackling the important issues facing America today, like the economic crisis, rising energy costs, reforming healthcare, and global warming. I will say this, though. I think we are at a turning point. I think that more and more people are understanding that this is not the country that we need it to be and that we want it to be and that we are entitled for our government to be. We have the longest lasting democratic government on earth. We have gone through cycles of corruption before, essentially, where, you know, back in the Gilded Age, at the end of I guess, 2 centuries ago, that were referring to some senators from states as saying the senator from Standard Oil or his colleague, the senator from Union Pacific. And that led to, you know, President Theodore Roosevelt in 1907 banning corporate contributions to federal candidates and political parties. And that's a ban that still stands, though people are constantly seeking to attack it. The point that we need to understand, and I think most Americans do understand, but that we need to convince our leaders and the courts, is that the First Amendment, our First Amendment right to free speech and political association, cannot possibly mean that we, the people, have no right to enact common sense rules to protect our elected democratic government from essentially being captured by the wishes and being dominated by the desires of the economic elite. And there are, I say we're at a turning point because there are so many more people that have awoken to this and are in this fight, and there are so many opportunities for people to get involved and make their voices heard. You know, we only have one vote at each election, but every day we can be calling our elected officials and saying, I care about this. Where are you on big money? In New York State, for example, the New York Times is reporting that Governor Cuomo will be including in his budget funding for the public financing program, the Fair Elections program that came within one, you know, just a few vote, almost one, in the last legislative session. So if Cuomo, you know, continues to show real leadership on this and make sure that this continues to be part of any budget deal that gets made, we will see New York State taking the extraordinarily successful example here in New York City of the public financing program we have here, which empowers citizen voices by providing an incentive with a 5-to-1 match so that our elected officials, instead of only having to call the Gold Coast, can instead spend time in their communities raising small amounts of money and having that matched as an investment in a citizen-funded government of, by, and for the people. There's, as I said, disclosure rules. California did a great job recently enforcing its disclosure laws, although I understand that we need to make sure they actually collect these huge fines, that were leveraged against the dark money network, which was connected to the Koch network that flooded California's elections in 2012 with dark money in violation of their disclosure laws. The SEC, in a penny stroke.
Liz,
you know,
unfortunately, we're
sorry,
out of...
could have a disclosure rule. So there are things, I think it's important to recognize that while corporate power...
Liz, unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you for the good work that you're doing and being out there and being a strong and honest voice for all of the people. Liz Kennedy in New York City. The website is demos.org. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Now let's say hello to you, Therese Lead. Hi, you, Therese.
Hello, Gary. Today, being Tuesday, it's open forum. The airtime belongs to the listeners today.
Great. Well, we look forward to it.
Thank you.
Right now, you, Therese Lead.